Have you ever looked at a picture of someone you'd never met and wondered what their story was? That's exactly what happened to me when I saw a picture of Donna August, today's guest, in Doug Minoway's great book, Fearless Genius, a photography book which documented the digital revolution in Silicon Valley from 85 to 2000. And I had to know more about her. A black woman leading an engineering team at Apple, her photo stood out for all the right reasons, among a sea of pictures of Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, John Sculley et al. 2 years later, and I got the chance to sit down with Donna to share her inspiring story with you. From being the first African-American, man or woman, to enter the PhD program at Carnegie Mellon, where she was researching AI, to managing the Newton engineering team at Apple, to selling her software business for $147 million. It's all the more amazing when you learn the obstacles she had to overcome. You're listening to the Danielle Noonan podcast, where I interview tech founders and innovators to learn the inspiring human stories behind the game-changing tech we use every day. And for the final episode in series two, my guest is Donna August. She has a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering and computer science from Berkeley. Donna went on to research artificial intelligence at Carnegie Mellon, where she spent the holidays interning at Xerox PARC in the early 80s, before heading to IntelliCorp as a software engineer working on products which incorporated AI. She went on to Apple, as we know, and she went on to Freshwater Software, which was her company. And sometime later, she went back to do her PhD and completed it when she was 60. This episode is one of my favourites. Donna's story is one of grit, faith, determination, ignoring the naysayers, and ultimately a great success story. But before we get into this episode, a quick note about sponsorship. If you want to sponsor Series 3, please do reach out and you can have your ad read by me each week at this point of the podcast and have your message reach over 120,000 founders and business leaders. But now, back to my interview with Donna August. Donna, thank you so much for joining me today. I've wanted to interview, I think it's been 2 years now since I got this fantastic book from a photographer called Doug Minoway, and it was called Fearless Genius, and he was documenting a really unique time in history where he followed Steve Jobs. He's one of the few photographers that got access to Steve Jobs, and obviously he was focusing on a lot of the tech companies like Apple and Microsoft, and I found a wonderful portrait of you, which piqued my interest because I was like, who is this woman? And ever since then, I wanted to interview. So I'm so grateful that you could join me today.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm really glad to be here.
One question I always like to ask right at the beginning is to get a better understanding of you. I want to ask you about your childhood and what were there any kind of particular experience that shaped you from your formative years?
Well, let's see. That's a good question, Danielle. Yes, I'd say definitely yes. And there are quite a few experiences that I would say shaped me. First and foremost, I would say my family, because within my family, we had so many different experiences and so many opportunities for informal learning that just deposited all kinds of skills and knowledge within me that I didn't even know I would need later on in life. So I would say my family really shaped me. And continues this to this day. I have four sisters, and my mother, who is now approaching 85. She'll be 85 this year, and we're, you know, with our families, our extended families, we're always in communication with each other, always sharing ideas and possibilities and brainstorming and our different experiences, bringing those together. So I'd say family is a key part of that, and then augmenting that, I would say school, because I always loved school. So for formal and informal learning, school has always been a space that shaped me with different experiences. Church and my spiritual life, my relationship with God has always been very important to me. And that has not only sort of shaped me to be able to respond to the situations I found myself in at different times, but also has led me and guided me in certain directions. So those are some examples.
That's fantastic. And I'll pick up on the faith later, because there's some questions I've got around that. In terms of your family, so you said there was four sisters. I mean, that's a lot of girls in one family, isn't it? What drew you? Because you ended up doing a degree in computer science. Is that right? And electrical engineering?
Yes, my first degree is in electrical engineering and computer science.
What drew you to that?
Well, I would say before I even knew what computer science or electrical engineering, what those terms even meant, long before that, one of the very, very earliest moments that or period of time that got me excited about technology were the Apollo space missions. Those were going on, like Apollo 8, 9, 10, 11. Those were going on when I was myself 9, 10, 11 years old, in that age. And I was just riveted to the TV whenever they would show that control room with all those computers and all those people sitting there monitoring and managing these space missions. And Apollo 11, that was the thing. I mean, it was the first lunar landing. It was just amazing. And that got me very excited about technology.
That's interesting, because I've heard other people say exactly the same, which makes me think, what will our generation, this generation now, what will they see on TV, or what will be a milestone now for them? In terms of technology, so you got excited about technology. I've read somewhere that you were really into, like, as lots of engineers are, pulling things apart and putting them back together. Is this something you yes. did a lot of as a child?
I did more of the pulling apart than putting together, but yes, and my family was very patient with me and in fact encouraged me to take the things apart and figure out what was in there and experiment and explore. I had a butter knife. That was my screwdriver. That was my undoer and my redoer. and I used it to take lots of things apart and just see what was inside.
Where do you think that curiosity came from?
I think it was a combination of just wondering and looking for answers, but also the encouragement of my family saying, well, if you're looking for answers, if you're wondering about things, then figure it out. Go try it. Go do something with that. I always had a lot of encouragement, even though I was the only member of my family who was inclined in this direction ever. So, you know, in my entire family tree before my time, this was not a part of our family background, but my family never hesitated to encourage me to explore that interest.
It's a really good parenting lesson, I think, that we should encourage our children. We often think they're breaking things when they're actually, you know, very curious and potential engineers in the making. You're a true pioneer. I've read, you know, there isn't a huge amount that I can read about you, but the stuff I've read talks about that you are a pioneer, like you were the first in your family to go to college. Is that correct?
Yes.
I never know. Okay. Because sometimes you read things and you think, well, you know, who stated that fact? Does it come from Donna or somebody else? And the other thing is that you went to do a PhD at Carnegie Mellon. And I understand that you were the first African-American woman to do a PhD there. Is that right?
I started the PhD program there, but I did not finish it. But I was the first African-American person, woman or man, to join that PhD program. And I was really happy to learn some of the things that I learned while I was there.
That's incredible. What drove you? Because you were obviously doing things and you know, just talking about the kind of tinkering as a child, but also going to Carnegie Mellon. These are things, you know, you're going a path that no one that you know necessarily has gone before. What drove you to do these things?
I would say that the single common element there for me is my spiritual life, my relationship with God. The directions that I've taken in my life, I've always felt are part of my calling. Are part of where I'm called to go. And I can try and be as prepared as I can be, but when it's time to move in a certain direction, I need to go prepared or unprepared and figure it out as I do it.
That's amazing. How does it, I mean, this might sound naive, but how does it come to you? Is it a sense of feeling within?
It is. It's a feeling within, and it's a feeling kind of in nature, a feeling of being in place in this world around us and everybody and everything having a responsibility to contribute in certain ways. And in my relationship with God, I view that God has a perspective that we don't have, you know, just a perspective beyond time and beyond the plane that we live in, and is just bringing people together and moving people around in different directions if we're willing to listen, if we're willing to follow our calling. And so for me, it's a combination of it comes from within and it comes from being in a place in belonging in the world.
See, what you're saying now actually rings more true now that I, because when I mapped out your career, there's various times where you've met people at various companies that you've then gone on to work with in other areas. So I think that's very interesting, the link. So you left Carnegie Mellon because you went, you'd already interned at Xerox PARC, where you met the future founders of IntelliCorp. And is IntelliCorp where you went?
Yes. So I joined the PhD program at Carnegie Mellon, as you mentioned, and I joined that program to do AI research. In that program at Carnegie Mellon, they had a fellowship available from Xerox Corporation that included summer internships at Xerox Palo Alto Research Center in California. And they asked me if I would like to have that fellowship, including a commitment to those internships. And I said, yes, that's perfect, because Carnegie Mellon's in Pittsburgh and my family's in the Bay Area. And so that would give me a way to be back home with my family in the summertime and do amazing and interesting AI research at Xerox PARC. So I said, yes, I'm in. So I spent two summers doing AI research at Xerox PARC. And during that time, I met some of the researchers who started IntelliCorp. And IntelliCorp was one of the first startup companies to use AI in building expert systems. So they invited me to put grad school on hold for a minute, which turned into permanent, but the conversation at the time was put it on hold for a little bit and join us because we're doing something brand new with AI. And I was interested in AI research, and also I was interested in learning more about business. And so this is a rare opportunity. I think I need to go do this. And so I did.
Can you tell us in a bit more detail about some of the work that you were doing there?
Yes, we were building expert systems for specific applications within domains. So for example, one of the folks working with us was a large bank that did foreign exchange trading. They had a few experts who were really, really good at foreign exchange trading. They wanted to create an expert system so that their newcomers, their novices, could learn from the approaches and the kind of rule of thumb thinking and the intuition of those more seasoned foreign exchange experts. So we built an expert system for them to do that. We also built one for another really wonderful company that creates adhesive products. And they had, similarly, they had experts who'd been formulating adhesives for decades. And they had newcomers, new chemists who were joining their teams and didn't have that much experience, but they wanted them to be able to operate at that higher level of expertise. And so we created expert systems to capture some of the knowledge and intuition of the seasoned experts so that the newcomers could learn that way.
That company was 3M, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. And so with the work that you were doing, what was the landscape like back then? I mean, what did people, kind of lay people, understand about artificial intelligence? Because I'm assuming it was a very different beast than it is today.
It was. It was still just emerging from the research labs and the universities. And folks were kind of casting about to see how can we begin to apply this in ways that are meaningful without trying to solve an entire gigantic problem. Let's take a small part of a domain-specific problem and see if we can start there. And that's what we did with expert systems. We talked with people in various industries about finding ways to capture what your most experienced person, you know, your internal expert, your go-to person, trying ways to capture what that person's knowledge is for those who aren't as experienced but would like to be able to learn that way. And when we explained it in those kinds of terms, people in a wide variety of industries said, well, yeah, we have experts and we have newcomers and we'd like to bridge that gap. What could you build for us? And so we went from domain to domain to domain, learning how to use a base set of tools to build expert systems.
That's really interesting. I think it's something, I wonder what the equivalent is today, because we have a similar issue now. We have also a lot of people that jump from one company to another and they're kind of taking their knowledge, and it's very interesting. Talking about going to another company, jumping to another company, Apple was some, you obviously spent a few years at IntelliCorp and then you went to Apple. Now, for people that don't really remember this time, it's 1990. What was Apple like when you turned up? Because it wasn't, Steve Jobs wasn't there at the time, was he?
Correct. He had left. He came back sometime later, but he was not there at the same time that I was there.
What was it like on your first day turning up to this environment? What was it like?
It was exciting. It was exciting. So many of the challenges in my life always start out as being exciting. It was a new chapter for me. It was a place, a company whose products I admired and had used for several years, but who I also felt, a company with products that I also felt were not reaching everybody because they were pretty expensive and they called for a certain starting point and a certain knowledge of navigating the tools and the operating system and the application that I could see in Apple's products that they weren't reaching a wide enough demographic of people. They weren't reaching a diverse, really widely diverse base of consumers. And so I was excited to be at Apple to see more about how the products got made within the company and also to see if I could help Apple reach more people, more and diverse communities and consumers of technology.
Yeah, I read that one of the things that you did when you were there, I think there's a New York Times article about you soon after the Newton launch, and it was saying that one of the things that was important to you, like you said, was reaching more kind of diverse communities. And one of the ways you went about doing it, I guess, is that you were hiring people that weren't the typical Apple employee. So I think I read that the Newton team was made up of the core team at the beginning was like someone knew somebody and hired that person. And I know that this still goes on today. We're often, you know, hiring with a lot of bias because we're hiring people that we know. So what was the hiring process like for you when you started to bring the team together?
Well, it's because I had just been through the hiring process myself. I had a few opinions when I arrived as the manager of a small, I was a manager initially of just a subset of the software team for the Newton. And it was all a very tiny team. So it was just like this had a few people on my part of the team. I didn't realize at that time that the person who hired me was going to be leaving in a few months, that I was actually being trained to take his role. When I first came, I was only going to be working with a small subset of the software team. And I spoke with folks on the team and I said, so, you know, when you all interviewed me, I noticed a few things about the process that as someone coming in from outside, we might want to make some improvements here. And part of what I learned from talking with and listening to my small team then, which would eventually grow to be much larger, was that the team had a certain way of recruiting that was mostly based on hiring people who attended the same computer science or software engineering program where we went to college. So we hire people who we know had training similar to ours because that academic background gives us something in common. Well, because I went to UC Berkeley for my undergraduate and I had worked in AI research and industry at IntelliCorp, as we were just talking about, I kind of made the cut, even though in some other ways I did not fit the mold. So I was rare in being brought in from outside and having more differences compared to most of the team than they typically would have brought into their recruiting process. So what I did was I said, let's learn how to recruit with more confidence in our ability to recruit and interview prospective engineers who come from different backgrounds, who don't come from the schools necessarily that we came from, but who are going to bring different backgrounds, different perspectives, different experience. Let's learn how to do that well. And everybody was game. Everybody was like, we know our game is kind of weak on the recruiting and the interviewing, we know that. So how can we make it better? And that's what we learned how to do. Fortunately, I had done that before. So I had some ideas and suggestions and everybody was receptive. And so we started recruiting in a different way for our team. And as a result, our team very quickly, because we were in growth mode, became a very diverse team.
That's so great to hear. So what would you say were the initial issues? So when you said that they were receptive, your team was receptive to doing this, the Apple I know today, there's a lot of layers. Did you have to go any higher or were you able just to recruit who you wanted to recruit?
In the Newton group, we had a hardware team, a software team, and a marketing team. And in the software team, we also had sort of the user interface and user experience team because that was part of software. So we had sort of three teams all as part of one group. And the team that I sought to influence right away was the software team. And that team was very, very open to learning new ways to recruit and interview prospective engineers with confidence. And as we started as a team learning how to do that, I think the team felt very empowered that they had a new skill, So everybody was feeling really good about bringing together this very unique and diverse team, because we knew we were building a product that needed to reach a lot more people than the Mac was already reaching. We were building a product that was going to be mobile and personal and innovative. We had to really get outside the box on this. And so we were on the same page.
And I was just going to interrupt there, but with the scope, what was the scope of the Newton? You said it was personal, it was mobile. Where did the idea start? As in how, because Newton, I think, the team had been assembled before you got there. What was its origins?
The team, so the initial scope was to create a very personal device that was designed to be, we coined the term personal digital assistant, was designed to be a personal digital assistant for a single user. And so the team included some longtime Apple engineers, some software and hardware engineers, as well as some marketing folks who I've mentioned earlier, product managers who were part of the team. And almost everyone on the team when I joined had worked on the Mac, on one or more of the Mac systems, operating systems, hardware, product management, marketing. So most of that Mac experience was already coming into the Newton team. But we wanted to bring in perspectives that were not just Mac, that were not so strongly influenced by our Mac expertise. We needed a different blend. We needed to bring in some folks from outside.
And how did you empower such a diverse team? Because you're bringing in these new people. You said it grew very quickly. One of the, I think, the skills that you showed early on was that your ability to empower others to kind of manage themselves. In terms of your management style, how did you empower, you know, this new diverse team?
Let's see. I don't know that I empowered them, but we started to claim our empowerment. We started to recognize that, you know, we clearly had a vision. The team already had a vision before I arrived of where we were going with this product idea. But what we started to do in the months immediately after I arrived was to shift gears into not just the what of what we were building, but the how it would be used, how we would deliver it, how the experience would feel for the customer, and integrating that how into the design of the software and the hardware. And so we started a series of iterations of prototyping and an iterative design process that continued to incorporate sort of deeper and deeper all of those aspects of how people would experience, how the users would have their hands on it, how they would put it in a pocket or put it in a purse, how they would open it up, all the aspects of how we started to integrate that. And in doing that, that empowerment just kind of came to us because we were like, okay, now we see not just where we're going, but how we're going to get there. Let's go. And we just started moving.
So I was going to ask you about the whole prototyping process, because I think what you were doing was clearly ambitious. And I know there were other companies that were working on similar things. I've interviewed Andy Hertzfeld, who worked on the Macintosh and was also at General Magic. Were you aware of other companies working on similar products, or were you heads down focused on yours?
Early on, we were aware of a few others because there were some conversations about possibly partnering. And so a couple of us from the Newton team and a couple of people from a few other different companies got together in a few meetings and said, you know, do we have something? Do we have any kind of synergy here where we want to do some work together? And some of the other companies in Silicon Valley who were working on mobile products in that space, we didn't seem to have a good connection, but we did end up partnering with folks in Japan. We ended up partnering with folks in Russia. We ended up partnering with a few other people a few other companies in the United States for different aspects. So we found partners in different places, but not necessarily folks who were already building mobile platforms. We ended up just really focusing on building our own mobile platform.
And with the initial idea, when it launched, how far removed was it from the initial idea, or was it fairly close?
It was a starting point, and that was how we viewed it. You know, when we launched, we weren't as ready as we would have liked to be, say, a year later, but we didn't have the luxury of another year to keep it internal and continue to work on it before bringing it out to the public. What Apple needed and what the community in general, the industry needed, was for us to put a stake in the ground and to say, this is a starting point. It's far from perfect, but it's a good, solid starting point. And now we and others can iterate from there.
And when it was launched, how did you feel? Because obviously I know that the team worked night and day for long periods of time. It's something you've put your all into. First of all, what could it do when it was launched? And second of all, what were some of the challenges once it was launched?
Well, the launch was amazing. The engineers, we were all concerned about certain technical aspects of the first new that we launched, like the handwriting recognition, which we knew wasn't quite ready. But, you know, as I was saying earlier, you have to start somewhere. And someone, you know, a group of people have to have the courage to say, we're going to put a stake in the ground and make a starting point here. So we were thrilled about the opportunity to do that. We were a little worried about the fact that we wish we had just like one more year that we could have made this more robust. But we were also really amazed and lifted up by the developer community and the early adopters who just rallied, and they appreciated this moment in history. I mean, we were so tired by the time we got to launch. We were not thinking of this as a moment in history. We were thinking of it as, can we get a minute here to catch our breath? But the developer community and the early adopters, they were just on it, and they were so just beyond enthusiastic. They wanted to be a part of this cutting edge, innovative computing platform. They recognized something that we kind of in our tired haze recognized as well, that this was going to change the computing industry in some important ways. And so we appreciated their enthusiasm.
Going back a bit, just when you were in the whole process of getting it done and you knew you had this tight timeline, which obviously adds a massive constraint, at what point did you realize we're onto something? Was it like straight away you were really excited, or was it further down the line when you saw someone use it for the first time outside of your Newton team? What was the moment that made you realize that this is going to change the game?
Well, we knew that we were building a part of the future for personal computing. I mean, we were at Apple, where personal computing, you know, by some accounts, personal computing originated there. And we knew we were building a next layer or a next chapter. And we knew that it had to be mobile. It had to be customizable for individual preferences. We knew that it was going to become a very personal device. So we were excited to be defining this emerging industry for Apple. But we didn't know where the trajectory would lead. We just had a vision of where what we were doing, what we were working on might go, where the Newton might go. We didn't have a view of the long-term trajectory of where this could lead as a part of communications and, you know, mobility from all the way from telecommunications to computing. We didn't know all of that. We just knew we were in the part of the starting point and we were going to see where it goes.
See, the thing is, you couldn't possibly know, really, because it was not written in the stars yet. But what's so amazing is that you were part of that important time in history. And I was going to ask you, because I read that there was like a year into the project, a whole load of code had to be rewritten. So I was going to ask you, what were like some of the harder times while working on this? What was a time where you thought, you know, is it going to happen? Like, were there some times where it was just like, is this going to launch? Is this ever going to happen?
No, we didn't have, in general, on the software team, we didn't really have a doubt that it would ever happen. It was more of, when can we get enough of it done for this to be a reasonable starting point, for this to be a reasonable stake in the ground? I've heard, and a number of people have asked, and I've heard people refer to the fact that, you know, all the code had to be rewritten. I don't really remember it that way, because we designed the code from the very start, even before I arrived, and certainly after I arrived. Our design was very modular, and the intention all along was that we would be revising modules as we go. So we continually revised and improved our code all along the way. And maybe people are referring to the fact that we made some changes to the base language we were writing in. But even with that, a lot of what we were building, you know, they were in modules with APIs. And so rewriting what's inside of a module in order to be able to continue to interact between the modules via those APIs, that's just a part of what we were doing anyway.
You know what it is, Donna? One person, one journalist will write something somewhere, and then we all quote it verbatim because we think, well, it must be true. So this is why it's always interesting to have the conversations with the people that were there, because then you find it's not quite what it seems. But thank you for clearing it up. I know that obviously working kind of on the engineering side, you then got the other side, which is marketing, which you said were one of the teams. Marketing and engineering can be quite separated sometimes in terms of what people want, as in the end goal, and what is actual reality. How did you manage that? Because you had John Scully, who was obviously going around and making announcements. How did you manage that in terms of, you know, coupling what the marketing team wanted and what was actually possible?
Well, one of the cool things about the Newton team was that we all worked together. The marketing folks, they were in our office space area, like all the time. They were talking with us all the time. We were talking with them. We were brainstorming together. We were whiteboarding together. We were sitting in on the user interface focus group sessions together and hearing the feedback and reviewing the videotapes from those sessions with the hardware people as well. When we got prototypes, we all got prototypes. So it wasn't like just software over here and hardware over here and marketing over here. Nope, we all got prototypes. And then when we got new prototypes, we shared around the old prototypes to everybody who didn't get one in the first batch so that we could just all keep it moving forward. We were in constant communication, and it was day and night, especially that last year. We were just there working around the clock, really hard, very diligently, and everybody on the whole team was working like that.
It seems like you were more in sync than I thought. In terms of the teams that you worked with, you were, like you said, working day and night. And I see from this book that I mentioned earlier, this photography book, I was amazed how many babies I saw in the offices and how many kind of, basically people were sleeping. It's the same for the Macintosh. Andy Hertzfeld has said that, you know, basically people were sleeping under their desks. When you're in that kind of culture and you're in that moment in time, how did you find some time for yourself, or was it there was none? Because you mentioned earlier about your faith, and I was just wondering, like, for someone that is so grounded in their faith and wanting to be in nature and everything, how did you marry that with this ridiculous workload that you had on?
That's a really good question. And yes, we definitely did do sleeping under the desks and under the conference tables. You know, keep a toothbrush in your desk drawer because that's where you're going to be when you wake up in the morning. Mm-hmm. We did a fair bit of that. But for me, I had a couple of boundaries. So I was a member of the choir at my church. We had choir rehearsal one evening per week. We sang and played for a couple of the masses on Sunday mornings. Unless I was traveling to Japan or somewhere else as part of the project, if I was, you know, in Cupertino, then I went to my choir rehearsals almost always on schedule, and I went to mass on Sunday mornings. I was exhausted a lot of the time, but I went. My choir friends sort of would comment as months went by at how tired, increasingly tired I was looking, but you know, I couldn't tell them what I was working on, just that it was important and it would be okay. So there was a lot of my family members were a little worried because I really wasn't even showing up for like major family events all the time. But everybody seemed to understand that I was following something I was very passionate about. And so I felt like I could have those boundaries so that I could have my time to renew and restore myself and still be able to go back and do what I needed to do at Apple.
Yeah, so many founders I speak to these days will often talk about, especially if they're launching something and it'd be pre-product launch, and they'll just go nuts and they'll be full on. And then obviously now we talk more openly about mental health. And I think having something that grounds you while you're also going full pelt at work is obviously very useful, because it helps you to keep yourself sane almost, you know, that you're following a path, and while you're working these crazy hours, you're keeping some normality. So you obviously loved your time, I'm assuming, at Apple. I know it was really hard work. Once it launched, how did you feel? What was it like the morning after you launched?
We launched in Boston. And as I mentioned earlier, the launch itself was really amazing. And the developer community and the early adopters were so excited. We looked around and said, this is even more of a sharing of an opportunity for us to share what we've been working on all these months than we realized it would be. We had kind of forgotten that all these other people would be in the sharing with us when it came time to launch. And when we got there to Boston and we did the launch and so many other folks were positive and supportive and so excited, we were like, oh, we almost forgot that they were waiting for this too. So we were really tired. And it was great to have the launch. It was great to have the community rally like they did. But it was also a little bit of a concern because we knew we had shipped with still not quite completely ready to roll software. So we were already planning, okay, we're going to have updates, we're going to have bug reports, we're going to keep doing our iterations and get bug releases out to the communities as people start to buy the product. And that's what we did. We rolled right into that. Now for me, I had already planned that after we ship, I was going to be, in a short time later, I was going to be moving on to my next chapter. And that's kind of the rhythm of new product development, is that folks commit in most cases to stay all the way through to shipping and releasing and doing the launch. And then you decide, are you going to recommit to the next iteration? And many people on our team absolutely recommitted to go to the next Newton and the next one after that. For me and a few others, we had known that when we got to launch, then we would be exiting to go do something different. And so after we did the launch and after we got that first few bug fixes and bug releases out there, I shifted gears to get ready for my next chapter.
And in terms of your next chapter, I know you went somewhere before you started your company, but I'm conscious of time. So I wanted to get on Freshwater Software. Can you tell me how it started? You had previously met John Mayer, your co-founder, but it was such an important company in time, an amazing company, an amazing journey. Can you tell me how it started?
Sure. Yeah, it was a terrific company. It is absolutely one of the best, among the best working experiences of my life, working at Freshwater Software. So John Mayer was the co-founder with me, and John and I worked together on the Newton. Separately, as we were exiting Apple, we both interviewed for a telecommunications company in Boulder, Colorado. And the people who were interviewing us separately talked with me and said, so we're interviewing one of the people who was on your team at the company you're coming from. So we can't really tell you everything, but we realized that we probably need to talk about this because that might be great news or that might not be great news. So how do we proceed? And I said, whoever you're interviewing, you can feel free to tell them I'm interviewing because it's not a secret. So they told John and he said, oh yeah, you can tell her I'm interviewing. So then we all got a chance to talk before we made our decisions. And we worked together at that telecommunications company in Boulder. And we were glad to work together again. And because we enjoyed working together and we respected each other's strengths, John and I decided to start talking about brainstorming ideas for doing a startup company together. So every other Friday we'd have lunch and we had a notebook and we were starting to figure out what could it be? What might we do? What do we see a market need for? And what do we see a skill set match for the two of us and others we could recruit? What's a good combination there? We were kind of looking for a Venn diagram overlap. And eventually that gelled for us after about 2 years. And we finished up the project we were doing at the telecom company and we launched Freshwater.
And tell me about Freshwater. What was your mission with it?
Our mission was to create the tools for systems administrators who were managing web servers to successfully manage those web servers. We wanted our systems administrators to be heroes. And that was the way we talked about it. We wanted to help them be heroes in their organizations. And so we wanted to give them the tools they needed to be heroes. They were increasingly finding themselves supporting web servers that were just coming out of the woodworks. First for internal use and then for external use and then for e-commerce. And they were flaky servers. They were crashing all the time. And the sysadmins were just, you know, this was not the way they worked with flaky crashing situations. This is really stressing people out. So we're like, we're going to create the tools so that you can make those servers reliable and robust. And that's what we did.
And how long did it take before you had something tangible? So you start this company, it's you and John. What kind of were like the early days like? And when did you have something that you could go out to customers with?
When we launched Freshwater, we first started developing our main product called SiteScope. We had gathered a team for John and I as the founders. We had gathered a team that we referred to as the founding team. There were five of us. So we recruited three people to join us. And my first role was to go and get funding for our company. That was a challenge for me because I'd never raised money for a startup company before in my life. When I was at IntelliCorp, that had all been done before I joined. So this was a whole new experience and a whole new challenge for me. And John and Pete, Jackie and Chris, the other four folks on the team, started working on the product. And we had some very clear ideas of what the most immediate needs for systems administrators were. So they started working on creating the core tools for that while I went to get the funding together. And that kind of evolved. So the whole funding situation turned into quite an experience of its own working with venture capital folks. In the meantime, we developed the product and we started getting into the hands of a few systems administrators who weren't yet customers, but who agreed to try it out as beta software.
Okay, so getting it out and having people test it is obviously a critical ingredient. In terms of fundraising, just going to that, I know that obviously not only had you not been involved in fundraising, but you hadn't founded a company and gone out and spoken to VCs. What was the initial reaction as a woman at the time going into these offices? Were you treated nicely or was it more of a challenge than you expected?
It was challenging. It was challenging. I'm a Black woman engineer. And I was pitching Silicon Valley venture capitals who told me, some of them told me point blank that I just didn't fit their mold. Wow. Several told me that, you know, they explained to me, we make funding decisions based on confidence in the leadership team. And they told me, we have no confidence that a Black woman engineer can succeed as a CEO of a technology startup.
I was not expecting you to say that. That's horrific.
Oh, I heard that from several people, including one of the two that eventually invested in our company.
Wow.
The way he described one person in particular described what they were looking for is he specifically told me, we're looking for an MBA, white male, preferably from one of the following, you know, leading MBA schools, and he named them off, who's had at least one successful startup in the past, but is still motivated to try really hard and work really hard for another success, preferably, you know, has to look good in a suit, has to present well to prospective customers and other investors. I mean, they had a whole model of what they were looking for. And I fit none of that. None of it. And I wasn't going to try and be something I wasn't. Mm. And the other thing, too, that complicated things is that we were headquartered in Boulder instead of in Silicon Valley. Mm. So that also reduced confidence that Freshwater would be, you know, part of a successful ecosystem because we weren't in Silicon Valley, where the most successful ecosystems, from their point of view, the VC's point of view, where those ecosystems existed. So part of what I had to do was I had to keep my temper in check. You know, I did a lot of praying to keep my temper in check and to navigate through all these biases without losing myself in the process. And the funding that we eventually got was contingent upon, we were funded by two VCs, and the funding was contingent upon the VCs finding an experienced MBA to replace me as CEO. And that I would take a different role on the executive team. And I agreed. I said, great, if we can bring somebody to the team who can do this better than me, we'll all benefit. Let's do it. Let's go find somebody. And they couldn't find anybody.
Surprise, surprise.
They couldn't find anybody who was either interested in what they considered our niche market. Only our brave little team was interested in our sysadmins. And we were fervently interested in our sysadmins. I mean, we always listened to those customers. The VCs, their candidates, they didn't want to move to Boulder and they didn't want to have a company with the key people in Boulder while they were in Silicon Valley. That would be too hard. So after putting in a third of their Series A investment, our VCs canceled their remaining investment and said, we can't find a CEO, so we don't want to do this anymore.
Wow.
So our brave little team had to figure out how to get profitable on our own because suddenly we had no further investments in front of us. We had no further runway. There was a silver lining, though, in that. It wasn't a happy time at that moment. It was very stressful. And I was very disappointed that that was the outcome, you know, that we had at that point in time. But the silver lining it is that because the VCs only put in a third of their Series A investment, they only had a third of the equity that they originally signed up for. So all that unassigned equity, we later distributed among our hardworking team of employees. And later when Freshwater was acquired, the employees benefited from that equity.
That is a silver lining. My goodness, Donna, I was not expecting you to tell me what you just told me. I've heard stories and I think I'm almost teared up. I think it's horrific. But I do hope that things have changed slightly over the years. But the thing that I really don't understand is what were they expecting? Because you are a Black woman, like you said, and when they invite you in, it's not like they've got John Smith written down. It's Donna August. What did they, you know what I mean? It's like, where was their research? Because to say that to someone's face is absolutely appalling and soul destroying. And I'm so glad in many ways that it didn't work out, because you went on to make a very good deal. Was it $147 million that you sold the company for?
Yes.
And now, did you ever write a letter, a little thank you note to those investors to say what had happened? I hope
let me add a couple of things that may help explain how some of those conversations came about. So I'm a very persistent person. And when I'm after something that I feel is a calling, I am very persistent. And so the VCs didn't invite me to pitch. I just hounded them until they let me in. And then when they were saying, we're not going to fund you, I demanded explanations. Why? You know, what could we do differently that would make our company more fundable? I've pitched, you know, 40 VCs and we still don't have funding. What do I need to adjust here? Give me some feedback. You can't just say no and walk away. I need more sentences following that. I need an explanation. And so I was pushing them to tell me what's going on here. And they were being honest about their biases. And those biases are completely wrong. But they were giving me frank, honest answers of, this is why we're not even thinking about funding you. You don't fit the mold. We make choices based on a team we have confidence in, and we don't have confidence in you leading this team. Wow. And so they were telling me what they viewed as their truth. And one of the things that was very interesting, though, much later, after our company succeeded, we had thousands of customers, our company was successfully acquired, one of the VCs said to me in a very heartfelt conversation that she had underestimated me and our team, and that she learned something from that. And that was important. And I was good with that.
I think that the fact that a lesson was learned is very good and it's important, like you said, but I still think that they could have, done things differently. But I understand how persistent you are. I think that's part of your success, isn't it? Not only knowing what your calling is, but then never letting go. And I'm sure, as we touched on at the very beginning, that faith has a big part of that, because when you know what your calling is, it's almost, you know, unthinkable that you wouldn't persist and go after it. So I know that we don't have much time left. I wanted to ask you, so you sold the company for $147 million. What did that feel like in terms of pride and just being able to wake up one morning and know that even though you had the naysayers who didn't believe in you, because of your faith and your family and encouragement and the team, the brave team that you said you had, you carried on and you did extremely well. So how did you feel once you had woken up the next morning after receiving this wonderful news?
Well, for me, you know, I give the glory and honor to God. I completely recognize that when we face impossible situations, that God can make a way out of no way. I mean, that expression has just been a part of my life and so many chapters in my life, to be witness to the times when God makes a way out of no way. So when I encounter the situations that have no way, I got prayer, I got faith, I got God. So I just keep going. For me, after Freshwater was acquired, I felt really happy because I knew our customers and our employees would be on a very good trajectory. I felt good about the fact that I had delivered a good ROI for our investors, even though we didn't have their support the entire time we were in business. But you know, when we started out with that investment, I knew their expectation was that they would get a good ROI, and I felt good about delivering that ultimately. I felt really great that our employees and customers were both winning, totally winning in this situation. Our customers had a win, our employees had a win, and I felt very, very happy about that. And then for me, I already knew what my next chapter was. I already knew what my next calling was. And so I was happy to turn the page, go to that next chapter.
Tell me what the next chapter was.
I started a nonprofit organization called Leave a Little Room and took a substantial amount of my earnings from Freshwater and put it into that nonprofit. So with a 10-year plan to do work in parts of the world where I felt like my problem-solving skills could be beneficial to people in solving local problems. So East Africa was where I went first, worked in Tanzania, Kenya, Eritrea, Uganda. And then we also did work in Mexico. We did work on Native American reservations in the United States. We did work in Haiti, in Louisiana and Mississippi following Hurricane Katrina. Different places where we felt we could go, hear what people needed, and get to work. Lend our hands and lend our minds to whatever problems people told us they needed some help with.
Donna, we need leaders like you. We need so many more leaders. This is one of the reasons for doing this podcast, is to hear these inspiring stories and inspire others and empower them, because, you know, we learn from others. We learn from others' mistakes, but we learn from others' successes as well. So you have done so much. What I know that when I contacted you, I think the very first time, and I said I wanted to interview you, you were in the middle of doing a PhD. And I think based on what I've seen, I think you were around 60. And this thirst, this forever going hunger and thirst for education and learning and bettering yourself and pushing yourself, it's obviously driven you to where you are now. What are you up to now? What are you working on?
Well, yes, I did finish my PhD at so you remember I started at Carnegie Mellon way back when, and then I didn't finish, right? So that was the deal. There's, I had my bachelor's degree, but I never did finish my master's or PhD at Carnegie Mellon. So then years later, after these wonderful journeys and other chapters, I felt like, okay, I'm ready now. I got some new ideas, and I'd like to learn more about how to do research around these ideas. You know, I've done a lot of the D of R&D, but I've only done a little bit of the R, and I'd like to learn more about the research part. So went back to grad school. I was 57 when I enrolled in the PhD program at University of Colorado in Boulder, and finished when I was 60, and learned a lot during those 3 years. And now I'm taking that work, those newly deepened research skills, as well as my existing development skills and skills with people engagement. And I'm doing work with sensor technology and data science. And of course, there's some AI in there, because I always have AI in there, to use these platforms, these sensor platforms, as ways to introduce communities to how data science can be put to work for them and by them. Would you like an example, or
yes,
do we have
please.
Time?
Yes, yes.
Okay. So one of the projects that I worked on, in Black communities, asthma has a very high prevalence in the United States. It's one of the communities with the highest prevalence of any communities in the U.S. for asthma. Working with indoor air quality sensors that can determine both particulates in the air, but also volatile organic compounds, or basically chemicals that are in the air, can potentially help families identify what in their home environment might be triggering their asthma. So with a small group of families, a small cohort of families, African-American families in the broader Denver area, what we did was for 10 weeks, various members of the family, children, adults, or children, parents, grandparents, learned how to collect data from the indoor air quality sensor while the families are doing their daily living, cooking, cleaning, just all the various activities you do at home, to determine what might be introducing particulates or compounds into the air that could trigger asthma. Collecting data from the sensors, and then collecting data about their family members' asthma symptoms, and building data sets and correlating the data to identify triggers that might be impacting their family's health.
It's such important work.
I think so, because it serves two purposes. One is to help the families shape their health management. They can make choices about say, for example, cooking with certain spices and oils puts particulates into the air that could be an asthma trigger for them. If they're seeing that pattern, make some adjustments either to ventilation or to the combination of oils and spices. But the choices are completely within the authority of that family to make in their home environment. No one from outside can decide that for you. That's something that the family decides together. So I think that's important. The other part that's important is to introduce, especially those young people in the family, to the power of using data to inform their decision-making. Collect the data, analyze the data, understand what it means, and then decide, are there actions that we want to take based on this data? That's the introduction of data science that I'd like for these young people to have, so that they might see that path as something they'd want to integrate into their future careers.
That's wonderful. I mean, I know you're a massive advocate for getting more younger people into STEM, and I think it's fantastic. The last question I had is what I ask everyone. So we start the interview at the very beginning, and I want to go back there. So if you can go back in time, what's one piece of advice you'd offer a younger Donna?
I would say, especially if I think of the younger Donna in my 20s, I would say to that younger Donna, watch that temper, girl. Because not everything that looks like a battle should be treated as a battle. There are a lot of other ways to resolve differences. So turn the flame down a little bit and use some other problem-solving methods more often, and then save all that temper and passion and everything for the times that the situations that really need it. Not every situation needs all of that all the time. Because I definitely had a bit of a temper going in my 20s.
Donna, thank you so much for your time. I have loved listening. I wish we could have gone on for 2 hours, because I know that there's so much more. This is the difficulty I have. I know that, you know, an hour is a good amount of time for a podcast, but 2 hours is what I really like. Further to that, would you ever consider doing a book? Would you ever write a book? Have you thought about doing it?
Well, it's come up a few times, and I'm more inclined to perhaps write some novels.
Yeah.
Because the storytelling of novels, especially to reach young adults, is something that appeals to me. So that might be something I'll do at some point, but we'll see.
I've got a feeling you're going to do it, Donna. I think based on past track record, I think it's something you'll do. Donna, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today.
You're very welcome. And I appreciate your invitation to be a part of this.
So that, my friends, brings us to the end of series 2, and I can't believe it, because it's absolutely flown by. I hope you enjoyed this series, and as always, please don't forget to like, share, and review the podcast. This means the world to me, and of course it helps others to find it too. I thought this was the perfect interview to leave you with, because Donna's such an incredibly inspiring role model whose story deserves to be told. And that is 100% the reason why I do this podcast, to share such stories and hopefully inspire and empower others to build. As Donna says when discussing the VC's reaction to her when fundraising, they had a whole model of what they were looking for, and I fit none of it. But Donna proved them wrong, and the lesson she shares shows you that you can too, whoever, wherever you are. I wanted to thank you, dear listeners, for coming on this journey with me. I have so enjoyed speaking to my incredible guests, Dan Bricklin, Rana El-Khaloubi, Nolan Bushnell, David Bytow, Avery Wang, Megan Smith, Ed Smith, and of course, Donna August. I am proud to have put this podcast out there in the hope that these backstories will document my guest legacy and that they inspire you too. And of course, I look forward to welcoming you back for Series 3 soon. So hit that subscribe button so you're the first to hear it. And I'll see you on the other side.